Hello and welcome to the Deathcast. I'm your host, author, and journalist Ian Totten. I'd like to thank you for joining me as we prepare to take our fourth look at the series of crimes known as the Texas Killing Fields. Before we get going, as always, I have the normal show notes. If you'd like to follow the show on social media, just search for Deathcast or Deathcast Official. If you'd like to help support the show, there's a couple of ways you can do that. First and foremost, you can go to your favorite podcast app, subscribe to the show, and leave a five-star review. You can also go to tinyurl.com/dcastpatreon, where for as little as $1.99 a month, you can get access to early ad-free shows as well as exclusive content, just like my friends Channel and Anthony did, as well as the largest Patreon contributors monthly, Samantha, Debbie, Becky, and Matt. They all went to tinyurl.com/dcastpatreon. Alright, now that all that's out of the way, find yourself a nice comfy chair, kick back and relax, grab yourself a drink. I've got my coffee, I've got my cigarettes. Let's go into the crypt! We left off last episode. We were looking into a string of disappearances and murders that had taken place in and around League City, Texas in the early to mid part of the 1980s, with three victims having been recovered from the Calder Road oil field, which was a privately owned piece of property. All three of these victims had been found within close proximity to where the others had been laid to rest. However, the horrors in and around League City and Galveston are only picking up. One thing people often wonder is how the Texas Killing Fields got their name. During the 1980s, a movie had come out called The Killing Fields, which was about the Khmer Rouge in Cambodia and the atrocities that they perpetrated against the Cambodian people. One reporter somewhere along the line is in Texas decided to compare the Cambodian killing fields to the fields between Houston and Galveston, and thus we got the moniker the Texas Killing Field. Specifically, the field they were talking about is this site on Calder Road. Although, because of the frequency of disappearances in this geographical location, that term has come to be an all-encompassing statement referring to all of these disappearances and murders that took place from 1971, at least up until the early 2000s. As discussed in prior episodes, it's my belief that all of these killings are not the work of one individual. No, we have a series of killings that can be ascribed to one individual or a group of individuals, followed by a quiet period wherein either the perpetrators are incarcerated, die, or move on to another area. Then a new perpetrator moves into the area and begins to hunt. During the period of time that many of these killings took place, these areas where the girls disappeared from and or were later found were fairly desolate compared to how they are now, meaning that over the ensuing decades, the whole Houston metropolitan area, including Galveston, has really boomed economically, and as with any place that has an economic boom, the population subsequently jumps, houses are built, stores, strip malls, all of that type of thing. So a lot of these areas are built up now, which may be one of the reasons why we have stopped seeing so many murders of young girls and women in this area. Because it's so populated, it is no longer as easy for a predator to hunt in this geographic location. Now, we're going to take a small step back to a period of time prior to the discovery of Laura Miller and Audrey Cook's bodies on February 2nd of 1986, turning our attention to July 29th of 1985. That was when a 29-year-old woman by the name of Ellen Ray Simpson Beeson disappeared. Friends described Beeson as a happy young woman who enjoyed bar hopping with her friends, which is what she was doing on the night that she disappeared. Ellen had gone to a local bar called the Texas Moon Club, which is located in League City, with her friends, where she had met a man by the name of Clyde Hedrick. Her friends were kind of surprised when Ellen and Clyde spent the majority of the evening together at this bar. They were more surprised later on when they decided to head out, and Ellen told them that she and this man that she had just met were going to go swimming in a local watering hole and that they could head off without her. Obviously, the next day, the friends and family of Ellen were worried when they saw and heard nothing from her. Now, Clyde's name is one that you're going to want to remember, as with a number of others that we've already discussed in this case. So, Ellen's family goes out looking for her, eventually making their way over to the lake that she and Hedrick were supposed to have gone swimming in. Naturally, they contact the police, who eventually begin looking for Ellen. And Ellen's body is eventually going to be discovered in a wooded area beside Old Causeway Road in Galveston County, hidden beneath an old sofa. And at that point in time, the medical examiner is unable to determine a cause of death. Now, moving back into 1986, we're going to look at the disappearance and subsequent murder of a 19-year-old by the name of Shelley Kathleen Sykes. Shelley is the first of these new spate of killings that is going to be Galveston-centric, in that she is going to go missing from Galveston, Texas, as are a number of other young women. So now on May 24th, 1986, 19-year-old Shelley Kathleen Sykes had just worked a shift at Gato's, which was a seafood restaurant in Galveston. It may still be. Really haven't looked into it that much. However, I know that at this point, at least, it was seen as something of an institution that both tourists and native Galvestonians had made a tradition. So this is a very popular restaurant along the waterfront, and it ties in, albeit briefly, to another case, that of the disappearance in 1971 of Renee Johnson and Sharon Shaw, as this is where their friend had dropped them off on the day that they disappeared. So now, Shelley is working this shift. She's waiting to punch out. The time she's last seen is somewhere between 11:35 and midnight, when co-workers see Shelley at the time clock. Now, a little background on Shelley. The previous year, she had attended the University of Texas in Austin. However, she decided to take a year off as she was feeling homesick and greatly missed her boyfriend, Mark, who was a year behind her. So Shelley decides she's going to change her plans. Her father and stepmother reluctantly agree to this, and Shelley returns to the Galveston area just after Christmas of 1986, at which point she gets a job working at the seafood restaurant. So now, after punching out, she leaves Gatos and gets inside of her car, a 1980 Ford Pinto. Earlier in that evening, her boyfriend Mark had reached out to her at work and asked if she wanted to come over. According to him, initially Shelley was reluctant, stating that she was tired and that her feet hurt, but eventually she gave in and told him that once she got off work, she would drive onto the mainland and go to Mark's house where they would watch movies. Now, we know that Shelley had normally carried a gun with her, something that her father had purchased for her as he had taught both Shelley and her older sister how to shoot. However, the gun he had purchased for her was too large, so the week prior to Shelley's disappearance, he had taken the gun back, intending to get her a smaller caliber weapon. We also know that along the way, Shelley stopped at a local fast food restaurant where she grabbed a burger. These are the last known movements of Shelley Sykes. At some point in those early morning hours, Mark reaches out to Gaito's, trying to find out where his girlfriend is. He learns that she had left quite a bit earlier, and according to Mark, the individual he spoke to, a waiter, said to him before hanging up, quote-unquote, "There are a lot of crazies out there tonight." So now, worried that there may have been a car accident as it had rained earlier that night, Mark gets in his car and drives down I-45 towards Galveston. And he makes this trip a number of times. And he later stated that nowhere during his many passes along this stretch of highway did he see Shelley's car. Eventually, Mark gets his father to help him look for Shelley, and while the older man drives, Mark looks out the window. Now, according to both men, it was as they left the restaurant for the first time and entered the on-ramp, which feeds onto I-45, that they saw a car sitting on the shoulder of the road with its dome light on. Mark asks his father to pull up to the vehicle, and very quickly they surmise that this is in fact Shelley Sykes Pinto. Now, immediately Mark and his father are concerned. This grows as they inspect the vehicle and notice that the driver's side window has been smashed from the outside. There was what appeared to be blood running down the outside of the door, but also splattered on the interior of the car. Eventually, they contact law enforcement, who arrive. Law enforcement starts to inspect the car. They notice that there is a bare footprint in the sand along the side of the road. Now, initially, police thought that there had been a car accident and that Shelley had simply wandered off somewhere, injured, dazed, confused, and looking for help. So they end up writing up an accident report, although why they did this really doesn't make any sense, given the fact that other than the blood inside the car and the smashed window, it does not appear as though there was any damage to the Pinto itself. The police asked Mark and his father if they wanted to take the vehicle from the side of the road, at which point Mark's father interjected, insisting that this was not a car accident and that they needed to secure the vehicle in an attempt to preserve any evidence that might be on the scene. Police eventually contact a tow company who comes and does secure the vehicle. In the midst of all of this, Shelley's father, Eddie, arrives. Arriving at the scene, he learns that nothing new has transpired, and dejectedly, he's sent home, where he says he sat by the phone waiting for some kind of update on his daughter. Later that day, Eddie, his wife and his ex-wife all go to the police station, at which point they officially fill out missing person paperwork. Now, unbeknownst to Shelley's family, at the same time they are at the police station, two witnesses have come forward. See, they had seen the Pinto the previous night driving on I-45. Both of these individuals described to the police how they had witnessed the car being chased by a pickup truck. The first individual, who was a male that was driving a station wagon, told police that as he was driving along I-45, the Pinto had pulled up behind him, and he noticed very quickly that this pickup truck was behind her. He said that the driver was driving erratically, and it seemed to him that the individual inside of the truck was intent on forcing Shelley from the road. According to this witness, at some point, the Pinto braked suddenly, swerving off the main concourse and onto an exit, apparently in an attempt to evade the pickup truck. However, the driver of the truck simply cut across the median. This man stated that he saw the Pinto become stuck on the side of the road, at which point the truck pulled up to the car. The driver jumped out, pulled off his shirt, wrapping it around his hand, at which point he began beating on the car's window. Now, this driver in the station wagon actually pulls off the side of the road to find out what the fuck is going on, and he said by the time he reaches Shelley's car, the man is dragging the young woman out of the car. It appears that she is barely conscious. The driver of the pickup truck starts screaming at the man that it's a domestic dispute and he needs to get the fuck out of there and mind his own business. Now, for some reason, the driver of the station wagon agrees and does drive off. When the pickup truck driver reaches behind him, apparently to get a gun. The other witness, a woman, agreed with most of the first man's statement, including the fact that she had seen the station wagon pull up. However, what she told police was that it appeared to her that Shelley was in fact conscious when she was dragged from the car, and was in fact attempting to frantically grasp the door frame in an attempt to escape the man. Now, from both of these witnesses, police are able to get a composite sketch of the man seen driving the pickup truck and pulling the young girl from her car. Up to this point, with the exception of Renee and Sharon, no one had come forward saying, hey, we've seen one of these girls or a group of these girls with someone that we believe was responsible for their disappearance. Shelley Sykes' disappearance, based on the stories that we have from these witnesses, it's obvious that this individual was meaning to do her harm. Obviously, the Sykes family had been holding out hope that Shelley had simply gotten into an accident and that she would be found. However, according to her father, Eddie, once they learned this information, their entire mindset on the situation changed as they realized that, yeah, it's as bad as we feared it might be. Now, according to Eddie Sykes, after learning this information, he reached out to a man that during this period of time was making national headlines, that being John Walsh, known in the U.S. for the television series America's Most Wanted, also for the abduction of his 6-year-old son, Adam, who would later be found dead. From what Sykes said, John Walsh told him to get whatever publicity he could on his daughter's disappearance, but also to put as much pressure on law enforcement as possible. quote, he said to keep the case in the headlines, to keep the cops out of the coffee shops and out on the streets looking for Shelley. Eddie Sykes ends up hiring a publicist to promote Shelley's case in the media. In addition to this, he also starts putting out missing posters with his daughter's face and physical description on it, in both English and Spanish, which were distributed to friends, families, neighbors, everyone that they came into contact with. Eddie Sykes later said that he believes they printed up around 300,000 of these flyers, which were distributed over 46 states. These flyers weren't just distributed by hand. They were also prominently featured on the back of some 18-wheelers that traversed the country. Now, as all this is going on, Shelley's boyfriend, Mark Spurgeon, says that he was crushed under the weight of not only fear over what had happened to Shelley, but also of fear that the police were going to try and pin her disappearance on him. He said that he was called in repeatedly by law enforcement and was also trailed by unmarked police cars. To quote Mark, I understand why they were doing it, but at the same time I wanted them to stop watching me and go find Shelley. Unquote. Now, all of these efforts on the behalf of law enforcement led to a influx of tips and information, much of which was tracked down and dismissed as not being relevant to the case. The longer this drags on, the more despondent everyone who knew Shelley became. Her father later said that as the months stretched on, he began to feel that maybe the man who was responsible for the Calder oil field slayings had been responsible for the murder of his daughter. This was helped by the fact that the term serial killer had only come into the lexicon a few years prior, and during this point in time, there were a lot of news stories on both television and in print discussing the phenomena that was and still is serial killer. This eventually led Eddie Sykes to travel to the Calder Road field, where he says he memorized every square inch of the field. However, he never came across anything. Eventually, because of Eddie Sykes' determination to make certain that the police do not give up their search for Shelley, the FBI gets involved. However, they, like the Texas Rangers and the Galveston police, are unable to turn up anything. And it's not until June 22nd of 1987 that any real headway is made in Shelley Sykes' case. On that morning in Ciudad Juarez, Mexico, which is just over the border from Texas and is roughly an 11.5-hour drive from Galveston, a man walked into a bar and saw one of the posters of Shelley that had been put out in Spanish. Witnesses later recounted that the man who was under the influence appeared disturbed upon seeing this poster and quickly left the bar. And he ends up making his way back into America, where he is staying at the El Paso Motel in El Paso, Texas, which is roughly a 30-minute drive by car, so he's fairly close. At 4 p.m. on the afternoon of June 22nd, the man contacts law enforcement, informing them that he has tried to kill himself multiple times, first by slitting his wrists and then by hanging. When the police arrive at the motel, they find the man, who they'd later learn was named John Robert King, in a state of duress. There is blood on his wrists, along with two suicide notes, one of which he had written on the back of his auto insurance card. And in these suicide notes, King claims to have participated in the kidnapping of Shelley Sykes. King was a 29-year-old unemployed laborer at this time. Officers end up taking him into protective custody and transporting him to a nearby hospital where he is under both constant supervision by doctors and law enforcement. The next day, June 23rd, law enforcement officially read King his rights and begin the process of questioning him. It's unknown exactly what King told officers during this initial questioning, beyond the fact that he did indeed admit to having been involved in the abduction of Shelley Sykes, and that he had participated in this abduction with a friend of his by the name of Gerald Pieter Zwarst, and that this abduction had taken place the prior year just outside of Galveston, Texas. The next day, King is released from the hospital, where he is picked up by police and brought before a local judge, where King again has his rights read to him, after which King goes to the El Paso Police Department, where he is interrogated at length by two detectives who had traveled from Galveston after being informed that a man had come into the custody of El Paso police claiming to have knowledge and to have participated in the abduction of Shelley Sykes. With a video camera rolling, these two detectives read John King his rights yet again and began the questioning. It was noted that during this first day of official questioning, King was unable to make eye contact with either officer, instead staring at the wall or the floor as he spoke in a gruff, somewhat monotone voice. If you don't really know anything about body language, when an individual is being questioned or is talking about something rather unsavory that they have done, and they feel guilt or shame, more often than not, they will not look the individual to whom they are speaking in the eyes. And what King told the officers on that first day was that he and Zwarst had been in Galveston on May 24th of 1986. They had been fishing, drinking beer, and smoking marijuana that had been laced with PCP. Now, according to King, they left the island around midnight that night, and as they were driving, they saw Shelley. He told officers that he had given her a friendly wave. However, something with that statement didn't sit right. When they pressed him for details, King simply stated, quote-unquote, "She shot me the finger." King stated that Zwarst was behind the wheel of the truck as they drove, and that when Shelley flipped them off, Zwarst completely lost it. Now, King claimed that Zwarst had become enraged, chasing after Shelley, forcing her off the road, breaking the driver's side window of her car before dragging her out. King also claimed that he was so high that he had only a fragmented recollection of what had occurred. The detectives weren't really buying this, but they pressed King for further details, and King admitted to helping Zwerst carry Shelley to the pickup truck and placing her on the floorboard. When asked why he had helped with this, King claimed that he saw Shelley was hurt and that Zwerst told him that they were going to bring her to a nearby hospital. When pressed as to why John King had attempted suicide and why he had reached out to law enforcement, he stated that it was the constant publicity that Shelley's case was reading, and then, quote, "I wanted to deny it. It couldn't have been us. It must have been us. I was going to run from it, get a job somewhere." King stated that as he was in the hotel room after having seen the poster for Shelley, he reached a moment of despair, attempting to hang himself with the shoelaces and slash his wrist with a razor blade. He finally broke down and called his mother, who told her son that he needed to reach out and speak with police. King was obviously distraught as he spoke to officers that day, stating, quote, "I can't believe I didn't stop Jerry. He busted out the window, or maybe I did. Now that I look back, it seems like a bad dream, a nightmare." Officers then turned to King and asked him why he had hit Shelley. King claimed that he had not done this, saying, quote, "I didn't do that. I know that for a fact." Officer, "What caused her death?" King, "It must have been the shovel." Officers noted numerous contradictions in John King's statement, such as the fact that he stated that he was not driving, while at other times saying that Zwerst was driving, that he couldn't recall busting out the window of her car, that it must have been Zwerst, before changing that and saying he may have been the one who had actually done this, that they were planning to take her to the hospital. However, when he realized that she was alive on the floorboards and began to move, he pushed her down with his feet, holding her there. At one point, he states, "I didn't know what was going on. It was like I was in a daze or possessed or in a blackout or something." King went on to give further detailed accounts that were largely in contradiction with what he had told the officers. He stated at one point that Shelley was lying in the back of the truck and that he had climbed on top of her, saying, quote, "I got on top of her. I don't know if I had intercourse with her. Then I heard her whimpering and crying. I backed off." John King further went on to state that eventually they had ended up at his parents' home in Backliff, which was roughly 26 miles north from the spot that they had encountered Shelley Sykes on I-45. King says that once there, Zwerst had gotten a shovel from the garage, and he and Shelley had disappeared into the woods. King later stated that at a later date, he had gone back to his parents' home and walked through the woods, and upon coming across an area where it seemed as though the ground had been freshly dug, he realized that something, quote-unquote, bad was there. John King later stated towards the end of the interview that he believed that Zwerst was going to try and pin the entire thing on him, while also claiming to have been in a drug-addled state the entire time. Officers pressed him, asking if he would be willing to return to Galveston and talk with Zawurst, and King eventually agrees to do so. So 4 days after the suicide attempt, John King returns to the Galveston area on June 26th. Wearing a wire, he goes to meet with his former Confederate. Gerald Pieter Zawurst was a 32-year-old unemployed pipe fitter. Throughout the afternoon of the 26th, as he and King conversed, John King continuously tried to bring up the abduction and murder of Shelley Sykes, although, according to official records, Zawurst repeatedly denied knowing what he was talking about. Eventually, this is going to lead the police to bringing in Zawurst for questioning later that evening. Eventually, when presented with the story that John King had told them, Gerald Zawurst stated that he did in fact remember the night. Officers noted that while the story was roughly the same, there were a few instances where Zawurst's story diverged greatly from King's. Namely, Zawurst put King behind the wheel of the pickup truck, and also as the one who had chased Shelley Sykes, forcing her off the road and breaking the window. Zawurst stated that King had then driven them to a park where he placed Shelley into the bed of the truck. However, he was uncertain as to whether or not his friend had actually raped the young girl, saying that the last time he had ever heard sounds coming from Shelley was when she had been lying on the floorboard and attempted to sit up. Quote, "The last time I heard any sound out of her was when she was on the floorboard. She tried to get up one time and he kicked her back down." Unquote. Officers later said that the entire situation sadly boiled down to this. The two men had been attempting to flirt with Shelley. She had been uninterested in their advances, and eventually she flipped her off, which threw both men into a rage, which led to them chasing her down the road, abducting her, possibly raping her, and then killing her. Although neither man would admit to have actually committed the act of murder, putting the blame on the other individual. As the night progressed, the officers brought King into the room, at which point they began to interrogate both of them at the same time, eventually demanding that the men reveal to them the location of Shelley Sykes' body. However, neither man would budge. They kept pointing the finger of blame at the other. Now, unbeknownst to either of the men was the fact that police had gotten some information since the time that John King had come forward. And what that information showed was that the blood inside of Shelley Sykes' Pinto from the broken window belonged to John King. They also were able to get witness identifications on John King as the man who had been seen driving the truck and busting out the driver's side window. That, coupled with the fact that John King had visible scars on his arm, led police to theorize that the story he was giving was most likely untrue. Not that Zawurst was innocent in any of it, but simply that King had placed his friend as the one inside of the vehicle committing all of the atrocious acts. In the interviews, King is eventually isolated from Zawurst, and it's at that point that officers start presenting him with this evidence. They stated later that King slowly realized that what they were telling him was true, and began sobbing uncontrollably. Although he continued to adamantly state that he couldn't remember, officers pressed him where Shelley may have been buried, and King stated that it was right out back of his mother's house, and also that he believed it was the shovel that had killed her, as he could vaguely recall jabbing her with a shovel while she was lying in the ground, although he could not recall specifically whether it was he himself, Zawurst, or a combination of the two who had dug the grave. Later, John King is read his rights again by a judge, and according to the judge, he heard John King muttering to himself, quote, "I have to get this off my mind. I done it. I done it. I can still see her body moving when I hit her with the shovel." Now, officers eventually let the Sykes family know that two men have been apprehended for the murder of Shelley, which obviously absolutely devastated them. As for the disposition of Shelley Sykes' remains, John King initially agreed to lead officers to the site at his parents' property where he recalled seeing the overturned earth. However, at the last minute, he decided that he wanted a lawyer. Now, a search does end up taking place at King's mother's house, where an estimated 600 officers, cadaver dogs, helicopters, and volunteers descend on the woods around the house in an attempt to find the area that John King had described. However, unfortunately for both the Sykes family and law enforcement, Shelley Sykes's body was never recovered. That did not stop the prosecutor's office from bringing charges against both King and Zawurst. However, without Shelley's body, they were unable to pursue the death penalty. Both men's lawyers attempted to dismiss the confessions that they had made, although they were unsuccessful in these attempts. The defense was able to get a change of venue, something that the prosecutors later stated they simply gave to them. That is how sure they felt of their case. As prosecutors began to work towards the trial, a number of individuals came forward with information that was helpful to their case. Now, some of these individuals had been jailed with Gerald Zawurst in the year after Shelley went missing, when he had been arrested for public intoxication. Now, according to these jailhouse witnesses, Zawurst admitted to having been in the truck on the night that Shelley disappeared, that he had said he had helped get her inside of the truck, and that he was there when John King buried her. He is also said to have admitted to seeing Shelley move and to King hitting her with the shovel until she stopped. The police are able to track down Zawurst's pickup truck, and inside of it they found hairs which were consistent with those known to have come from Shelley Sykes's body. John King was tried first. During the prosecution's case, multiple witnesses took the stand, describing King as the individual they saw both force Shelley from the road, break her window, and begin to beat her as he dragged her out of the car. Now, these statements were countered by King, who took the stand in his own defense, insisting that he was not a kidnapper, he was not a murderer, and that it had been Gerald Zawurst who had actually done the crime itself. Now, because he had taken the stand in his own defense, prosecutors were able to question King about Shelley's remains, where they were, whether or not they had dug her up and disposed of them like garbage, all of which King denied, repeatedly stating over and over again that he simply did not know. John King ends up receiving a life sentence for kidnapping. At his trial, Gerald Zwirst had completely changed his story, insisting that he remembered nothing, that he was too high and had spent the majority of the evening passed out, thus, in his mind, absolving him of any responsibility in Shelley's kidnapping, possible rape, and murder. He, too, ends up being found guilty of kidnapping and is given a life sentence. When questioned later, jurors stated that they felt absolutely certain that both men had participated in the kidnapping of Shelley Sykes and had almost certainly committed her murder, but that because officers were unable to produce a body, they could not state beyond reasonable doubt that Shelley Sykes had in fact been murdered. Afterwards, the police went to Gerald Zwirst, offering him a deal. If he would help them locate Shelley Sykes' body, they would not pursue capital murder charges against him. After consulting with his lawyers, Zwirst agreed to this and was eventually hypnotized. This led officials to a park that was located not far from a power plant where John King's father worked, which the family had spent a lot of time fishing at. While officers found a white blouse in the area that Gerald Zwirst brought them to, they were unable to find any remains, and her father surmised that it most likely did in fact belong to his daughter. Cadaver dogs were said to have hit on a spot in the area that Zwirst had instructed them to go to. However, nothing was ever found there, and it was law enforcement's belief that one or both men had gone back to the spot after Shelley was murdered and had removed her remains to an area unknown. Now, the final case from the 1980s that has been lumped in with the series of crimes known as the Texas Killing Fields is quite a bit different from the other crimes that we have thus far discussed. And that is the disappearance of Suzanne Renee Richardson, aged 22. Richardson, who went by her middle name of Renee, was a student at Texas A&M University, which is located in Galveston, Texas. She was working as the front desk clerk on nights at the Casa Del Mar condominiums, which are located on Seawall Boulevard. It's known that Renee was at the desk throughout the night, as a number of security guards told authorities that they had seen her there sometime after the security guards left the property. An employee of the condominiums who was asleep in a room above the office stated that they heard a female scream, followed a few moments later by a car door slamming, another scream, and the sound of the car leaving the premises at a high rate of speed. A guest went into the office at roughly 6:30 a.m. and found the desk unattended. Officers stated that there appeared to be no sign of a struggle and that Richardson's personal effects, including her car, purse, and a book that she had been reading, were left at the resort. Authorities later discovered a shoe in the parking lot, which was positively identified as having belonged to Renee Richardson. Richardson has been described as 5'8" with brown hair and blue eyes. She was last seen wearing a blue blouse, a denim skirt, and tan shoes. Now, officers eventually located a suspect. This man's name was Gabriel Soto, who ended up dying in July of 2002 from a drug overdose. Now, officers state that witnesses placed Soto at the hotel around the time of Richardson's disappearance, while another witness told police that they had been told by Renee Richardson to avoid Soto. It is unknown what their relationship was, but we do know that Soto attempted to run an individual over with his car at some point prior to ODing. Authorities stated that in 2001, they had questioned two cousins in relation to Richardson's disappearance, as according to various Galveston media sources, officers had circumstantial evidence that tangentially tied the men to her disappearance, although both of these individuals denied any knowledge. In 2004, a witness came forward stating that they had seen two men digging up Richardson's body in 1992 and moving it to another area. While police did in fact investigate the sites identified by this witness and found fragments of bone, these were later determined to have come from animals. Now, some have tried to link Renee Richardson's disappearance and almost certain murder to others in this spate of killings based on the circumstances of the crime as well as witness statements. It's almost certain that Renee Richardson's crime, beyond geographic location, is not linked to any of the others, and is, much like Shelley Sykes, a standalone case in all of this. To date, no suspects have been arrested in Richardson's disappearance, and it is unlikely that, without any form of forensic evidence or new witnesses, that her case will ever be solved. We're going to end the episode at this point. I hope that you guys have enjoyed our fourth look into the Texas killing fields. We will be back next week with another episode. Until next time, stay morbid.